Welcome everyone to our JCC Lunch and Learn program, The Golden Calf, Then and Now. So what I'd like to begin with today is a clarification of the nature of the class, what we're going to explore. Because very often history is nested within history, meaning sometimes events unfold over time, and it's only when we look back in retrospect that we fully take in the nature of what that historical event means or meant to us, whether as a society, as a people, as a religion. And this is very, very true in the case of the Golden Calf, because we have begun in Judaism a very sad period of time right now. We began this period Saturday, Sunday of this past week. And the period of time is often referred to as the 3 weeks. And it's not a positive, it's not a happy time. And essentially this time is 3 weeks of mourning, where we minimize our joy. And as we get to the culmination of this period, called the ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av, we get downright sad to the point where we fast, we have lamentations, and we are mourning specifically for the loss of the temples, both Temple 1, Solomon's Temple, and Temple 2, the second temple of Ezra, Nehemiah, that was destroyed in the year 70 by the Roman Empire. And because that temple has never, to this day, been rebuilt, so when you visit, for example, Jerusalem, you see the famous Kotel, the Western Wall, that is the outside retaining wall of that second temple. And so this period of time begins on the 17th day of Tammuz. Interestingly, though, when you go back far enough in the Torah, in the Bible, the actual event that first tragically happened on that day, the 70th day of the Jewish month of Tammuz, had absolutely no connection to Jerusalem or the loss of a temple. Rather, it had to do with the golden calf, as we will see today. So what we will try to understand at the end of today's class is how the golden calf issue resulted in the destruction of a temple, and that the two are interconnected, but because history played out. In other words, if you lived at the time of Moses, Joshua, et al., and you said, well, what's the tragedy of the 70th day of Tammuz? They would say to you, oh my gosh, the Jewish people were at the foot of Mount Sinai. They couldn't wait for Moses to come down, and they built a golden calf, and it was horrible. Moses shattered the Ten Commandments. That would be the tragedy of the day. But if you speak to a Jew 1,000 years later and you say, well, what's the significance of the day of the 70th day of Tammuz? They who were not at Sinai would not necessarily even refer to Sinai. They would refer more specifically to the more recent events, the breach of the wall of Jerusalem, which led to the downfall of Jerusalem, first by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia and then by the Romans. So you see, interestingly, that there's this historical interplay between the same day, but that they don't seem to be interrelated. But we're going to see today, actually, they are. And perhaps the then aspect will create a now aspect, what we can learn from it, the takeaway for today. So let's begin with source one. So in the condensed code of Jewish law, often referred to as the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the condensed version of the Jewish law, it tells us that on the 17th day of the Jewish month of Tammuz, which was Saturday past, but was actually in respect to Sabbath and Shabbat's sanctity, we didn't fast on the Saturday, so therefore we pushed it off till Sunday. On this day, there were 5 disasters. 1, the tablets were broken when Moses came down from the mountain. So we're obviously going back now chronologically. That was the first tragic event that happened on that day. 2, the daily temple offering was canceled. In temple times during the siege, they canceled it because they no longer had any animals left with which to sacrifice. That was a horrible thing, to lose the sacrifice. Number three, C, very famous to us here today. The city walls of Jerusalem were breached during the destruction of the second temple. Interestingly, they were breached on the ninth day, 8 days earlier, by the temple number one. But rather than have two separate fasts, one subsumed the other so that we wouldn't have to have a fast on the ninth of Tammuz, a fast on the seventh day of Tammuz, and then a fast on the ninth of Av, we'd be getting close to Ramadan if at that point, right? So Jewish people, very, very seicheltic, I would say, very logically decided to just commemorate both breaches on the 70th day of Tammuz. Number D, number four, a wicked Roman ruler named Apostumus burned the Torah. And it was really the very first time this had ever transpired, and we know, sadly, was not the last time. That was sort of the precedent-setting time where our non-Jewish enemies started burning Torahs, and that just happened time and time again during the Dark Ages. Of course, we know what happened in Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. So this has transpired over the times. And then number E, lastly, an idol was set up in the temple by the wicked ones of Israel, which caused our destruction and exile. So there are five events that these events all happened on the 17th day of the Jewish month of Tammuz. First was the tablet situation. So let's now go into the Bible, into the Torah, and analyze a little bit of the events of the golden calf. We've heard a lot about the story of the golden calf, but perhaps we don't know some of the details. So let's begin with number two. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go descend, for your people that you have brought up from the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned away from the path that I, God, have commanded them. They have made themselves a molten calf, a golden calf, an egel hazahav. And they have prostrated themselves before it. They slaughtered sacrifices to it and said, 'These are your lowercase gods, O Israel, who have brought you up from the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and behold, they are an kishe orev. They are a stiff-necked, stubborn people.'" Not much changes. "Now leave me alone," God says to Moses, "and my anger will be kindled against them so that I will annihilate them, and I will make you, Moses, into a great nation." Moses pleaded before the Lord his God and said, "Why, O Lord, should your anger be kindled against your people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt with great power and with a strong hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'Huh, he brought them out with evil intent to kill them in the mountains and to annihilate them from upon the face of the earth'? Retreat from the heat of your anger and reconsider the evil intended for your people." Stop. So let's analyze what happens. Moses goes up after God publicly gives us the Ten Commandments, what we call the Decalogue, the Revelation. He goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. He tells the Jewish people, "I will return in 40 days and 40 nights. Arba'im yom va'arba'im laila." So he goes up, and he is essentially on the summit of Mount Sinai with God, covered in the clouds. He does not know at all what has transpired down below. And he is shocked beyond belief when God informs him, "Get down. Your people have become corrupted. They built a golden calf." The rabbis say he is so shocked, he doesn't know how to respond. So God says, "Oh, by the way, stop asking me not to destroy them. Let me wax my anger against them and kill them all." So Moses thinks to himself, "Wait a minute, I haven't prayed because I thought this is so profoundly deviant. The Jewish people should build a calf at Sinai? A god or whatever they think it is and bow down to it? At really? 40 days removed from the Decalogue, the Revelation? This is what they've done?" So he thought that the power of prayer could not overcome such a grievous sin. So he didn't say a word. But when God says, "Stop praying, let me destroy them," God was actually signaling to Moses, "Pray, please. Time to pray. It's not beyond prayer." So immediately, Moses starts to pray on behalf of the Jewish people. And the first thing he says, "It's not my people, your people. You, God, brought them out. And why are you getting so angry? After all, where did they get the gold from that they manufactured the golden calf? Oh my gosh, They got it at the sea. Who gave them the gold? You did. So it's such a surprise that a people who is a slave nation, and that only just a few months ago was released from captivity, and they had idolatry galore in the land of Egypt. So you're so surprised that you give them tons of gold, and they wind up building a calf? It's not such a surprise. And in fact, the rabbis go a little bit more graphically. It's sort of, here's the analogy, taking a young man and dropping him off at the door of a house of ill repute with $1,000 of gold in his pocket, and you're surprised, Dad, at the outcome? Really? I mean, you're kind of supplying them the gold, and they already have the knowledge of idolatry cemented in the front of their consciousness. And they have that Yetzirah, that deep, dark desire to worship. So you're so surprised? Why are you getting so angry? He literally says, Lama Yechiratcha. Why are you getting so hot under the collar? Now, if it wasn't Moses, I would dare not speak such words to God, right? But you see that Moses reacts kind of, I wouldn't say laissez-faire, but the defense right up front is, God, you gave them the gold. They're a nation that has just been sprung from their bondage. Are you really surprised? Why are you getting so upset? What's the big deal here? Let's look at number three. Oh my gosh, let's see how Moses reacts. So Moses is told at the summit of Sinai what has transpired. But then he comes down, he sees Joshua halfway down. Joshua and he hear the cries from the camp, and they come down and they witness the calf with their own eyes. No longer a report from God, as if you couldn't rely on a report from God, right? But listen to how Moses reacts. It happened as Moses drew near the camp and saw the calf of the dances, that Moses' anger flared up. Now he's the one ready, just poof, nuclear option. He threw down the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of Mount Sinai. Now this is a strange event, I would offer. And this is really the crux of a question we have to ask. Up on the summit, Moses is kind of like, okay, God, you gave them the gold, you know? But now he sees the reality, boom. Now, simple explanation. It's one thing to hear about, to hear a report, even if it's absolutely trustworthy, because, I mean, what could be more trustworthy than God himself telling you? But to see the reality, the video, shall we say, that the pictures that go with it has a much more profound effect on a person. So you could say, well, conceptually, he heard about it, yes, but now that he's had time to process, remember, up on Sinai, he had no time to process what had happened. He was shell-shocked by the reality of what the Jewish people had done. But now he's had a little bit of time to kind of come to terms with it. And then when he descends and sees the video with his own eyes, boom, then he reacts.
Quick question, if I can ask at the time. When he wanted to annihilate them, we know that not everyone was involved, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Did God intend to annihilate just those guilty, or everyone?
Excellent question. So there are differing opinions. The simple explanation would be, it's an excellent question, Bruce. He's asking, when God says, let my anger flare, and I'm going to start with you, Moses, it seems to be saying clearly that Moses, you're going to become the new Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob altogether. That I am done with this nation. They're garbage. Look what they've done. And they're capable of building a calf. When I gave them the Torah 40 days and 40 nights ago, this is their state of reality? Really? I'm over with them. However, as you'll see as it unfolds, there's no question that the blame does not lie with all of Israel. The blame specifically lies with what we call the Erev Rav, the mixed multitude of Egyptians and other slave nations who had been accepted by Moses to become Jewish, had left through the sea, had come to Sinai, but apparently had not given up on their golden calves. They had tons of deities that they worshipped in Egypt, and they brought them along in their pockets, and they were very, very close to the reality of idolatry, and they provoked it. And we'll see in a moment how we see it. But I would suggest to you, at the moment where God says, I'm starting again, He's saying, Moses, if you don't invoke the power of prayer at this moment, it's over. Was God serious? I think he is serious. Why would you sink the ship with the good and the bad? That's a separate question. It didn't happen. He was hoping clearly. In other words, he's not just hoping. He is provoking Moses to pray. Because Moses at this point has never been taught the wonderful Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum V'Chanun, the prayer that will always tap into God's unlimited resources of mercy. That actually happens as a result of this golden calf sin, that God says to Moses, by the way, in the future, if you guys mess up again, this is the secret recipe that will tap into my unlimited mercy. So you will never have to worry about destruction again. But that's a theoretical. At this point, it's still early in the game, and Moses is so shell-shocked that he needs God's direction, which is a very profound idea, that nothing, nothing is beyond the power of prayer to evoke change. Now remember, we don't always get the prayer answered. This is true. But the prayer will be answered at some point in time. So for example, it's a very tough thing for us to live with, but if we pray specifically for something, some individual to feel better, what if they don't? It's very demoralizing. We say, oh my gosh, I prayed with such feeling and compassion in the heart, and God didn't answer me. Well, we don't know what the ultimate answer is. That's a question we have for God that one day we'll ask. But we know that every tear and every prayer that is given over to God does not get wasted. It may not be used for the person we intended. Maybe there's someone else in the world who needs that prayer. And God will direct your feeling and your compassion, your heart and your gift of your mind and your soul and your heart towards that other individual. It's a very tough thing because we as humans are limited in our scope. Okay, thank you for that question. Let's get back. Please turn to page 2, the back of your page. So let's now try to understand the answer to this question. How come Moses on Sinai at the summit is a little bit laissez-faire? God, you gave them the gold. Big surprise that they turned to a golden calf. And then when he comes down, shatters the tablets, yells out famously, whoever's for God, come with me. The Levites gather around. They put to death all the sinners, and it's a different type of Moses. Well, what happened between the summit and the base of Sinai? Again, the simple answer is he was dealing with the shock of a new event. He processed it as he came down. He sees the reality. He reacts to the reality of his visual medium. We know that the visual medium is the most powerful medium. Unfortunately, you know, for our people, for Israel, you know, you show a picture, you present an image on TV or in the newspaper, it's very profoundly affecting. So let's look at source 4. Moses was late. So the people build the calf because Moses is late. It says, Boshesh Moshe. He was late. He delayed. Well, how long was he late? This is remarkable. As Uncas, who was a very, very famous Roman nobleman, I made a little comment at the bottom of the parentheses, you might find this interesting. Uncas was a Roman nobleman. Many say he was the nephew of Titus himself, who famously converted to Judaism. And what's amazing about Uncas is that apparently when his uncle Titus found out about it, he sent emissaries to try to talk reason to his nephew. And each of the emissaries came and spoke to Uncas, and he basically converted them to Judaism. So that at some point Titus said, okay, Dayenu, enough already. I get it. There's no going back. And Uncas is right there on the page of most Bible translations. You have Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki's commentary underneath Rashi, and on the margin you have Uncas. Now we don't pay as much attention to Uncas because his commentary is a little hard to understand. It's written in Aramaic. So it's a language that's a little foreign to us today. But he is one of the go-to Torah commentators. So Uncas explains that the word boshesh is the term for lateness. For when Moses ascended the mountain, he had told them at the end of 40 days and 40 nights, I'll return within the first 6 hours. They thought that the day that Moses ascended would be included in the 40 days. But actually, Moses had told them full days. In other words, 40 days, each day with its preceding night. But the day that he went up, that he ascended, its night was not part of it, for he ascended on the seventh of Sivan. in the middle of the day. Consequently, the actual 40th day was the 17th day of Tammuz. That's the day, of course, that he shattered the tablets. Now, what happened? On the 16th day of Tammuz, the Satan came. We'll talk about who is this Satan character. And he caused disorder in the world by creating the appearance of darkness, deep gloom and confusion, so as to lead people to say, Moses has certainly died, and therefore the world has been thrown into disorder, into chaos. He said to them, Satan, Moses has died, for 6 hours have already come and gone, and he, Moses, has still not come back down, as is related famously in Tractate Shabbat. Okay, let's stop for a second. First of all, first question, who is Satan, Satan? So again, are we talking metaphorically? Are we talking about the guy with the horns in Christological myth? No. Satan usually is a term for what's internal. We have within us what we call the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. So that little voice that speaks to us, now that voice can be the good voice or the bad voice. Rationale. So when you need to do something positive and you start to rationalize to yourself why it's okay not to do it, probably that's the voice of your dark side speaking to you. We all know that from experience, right? And hopefully you stop. You say, wait a minute. If I have to rationalize why I shouldn't do it, then I probably should be doing it and I need to kick myself in the pants and do it, right? That's usually the case. So clearly, when it's talking about a Satan coming, it's the voice within the masses that's speaking to them. And what is the voice saying? The voice is whispering to them. Moses must be late. He said, I'm coming back. He must be dead. Without Moses, our connection to God, our leader, the one who split the sea, oh my gosh, we can't recast Charlton Heston. He's dead, right? What are we going to do? And the people went crazy. They needed a replacement for Moses. So the calf, by the way, contrary to popular opinion, which is wrong, was not a replacement for God, no matter what they said. In the hearts and minds of most, it was a replacement for Moses, their leader, their shepherd. They were literally like little sheeple. They were little sheepalach who couldn't think for themselves. They had just been a slave nation. Moses was everything to them. He was their guide, their father, the shepherd. And the little sheep are looking around. Where's dad? Where's the shepherd? Where's the border collie? I don't see anything. What am I going to do? And they said, well, we need a replacement, clearly. Now, you notice that Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, quotes here something interesting. That it says that there was this appearance of like darkness and deep gloom and confusion. Now, it's interesting. I'll just use it again as a metaphor. We spoke about how maybe Satan, is this metaphor for our internal voice that speaks to us, good and bad. You call this identity, whoever you are. And we know that from experience, you know that when you're at conflict with yourself, you may even catch yourself actually literally speaking to yourself. People do this, right? Hopefully you don't do it too much or we may institutionalize you. But if we all do this, right? We speak to ourselves, speak to myself out loud. You know, is it good? Is it bad? Is it indifferent? Whatever. And hopefully we have that voice of reason. So in addition to that, we notice it talked about a darkness and confusion. When is the most difficult time to see correctly? We call that actually twilight, correct? Try driving when it's not yet dark and it's not yet It's already beyond light, right? It's the single most difficult time to drive. It's very scary. You don't see people. Why? Because you don't have night vision yet. And yet, it's not daytime. So that's what happened. They couldn't see clearly. So it's using a metaphor that there's this murkiness, this cloudiness that clouded their minds, kind of like the shadow. And they couldn't see clearly. They were confused. There was a state of confusion. And that confusion could be self-imposed. Very often that happens to us. Okay. Then number five. And the people cried out. They said, Moses is dead, the one who brought us up from the land of Egypt and taught us the way to go. Now we need gods who will go before us. Not to replace the big God, but to replace Moses, ostensibly. So they come to their two leaders who are left in charge of the masses. Aaron, the priest, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and Hur, who is the son of Miriam, the older sister of both Moses and Aaron, and the nephew, then, therefore, of Moses and Aaron. And they come to them and say, you know, Moses is dead. We need some help here. And Aaron and Hur are listening to this. And the rabble, the mixed multitude, surrounds them in a very, very dangerous way. We all know the capabilities of a mob scene. This was the first mob scene that we know of. The power of the mob can do irrational things. That's exactly what happens. They get heated under the collar, and Hur looks at the mob. Now, he's the nephew of Moses and Aaron. And he says, are you guys insane? Will you look up? There's Sinai right there. You heard God speak to you 40 days and 40 nights ago, and you're asking to build gods? Are you out of your minds? Now, you might think, gee, that's courageous of him. Yeah, it was very courageous. Didn't go very far, though, because they killed him right on the spot. Aaron looks at his nephew, who is now dead, and he's not afraid to die. He'll go down with the ship. But Aaron is worried, because they say that when you kill a priest and your leader, a Navi, a prophet, in one day, there's no going back. And Aaron realizes that if they murder him in the way they murdered his nephew Hur, Jewish people are done. God is going to wipe them out. So he pretends to go along with the masses. Okay, so let's have a look. Number six, what does Aaron do? He's a very smart guy. So he realizes the problem is these are men and they're idiots. But the wives are smarter than the men. And let's bring the issue up to a family debate. And I will delay. I will procrastinate. And by the time the issue is resolved, Moses will come down and the day will be saved. So he says to them, okay, I'll go along with you guys. You want something? You want like a golden calf or a golden object to replace Moses? Okay, so he feigns cooperation. And he says, go get the jewelry out of your wives' ears that they gathered by the Red Sea. Bring it to me and we'll see what we can do. Knowing that when the husbands go running home to their wives, overwhelmed with this need for some type of idolatry or release through this golden calf, that the wives are going to take the frying pans out and whack them across the heads, and the issue will be resolved, right? So that's what Aaron says. Aaron thought to himself, number six, the women and children fancy their jewelry. Perhaps as a result, the thing will be delayed, and in the meantime, Moses will arrive and save the day. But they did not wait for the women and children and took off their own jewelry from themselves. So what did they do? They went home. Their wives threw the tea kettles and the pots at them. They left the tent, and they ripped up and took their own gold and brought it to Aaron. So Aaron took it from them, and he made one little mistake. He touched the gold. He shouldn't have touched the gold. They had accumulated a ton of this gold, and it says they threw it. And what did they do? Number seven, a molten calf, this golden calf, the Egel HaZahav. As soon as Aaron threw it into the fire in a melting pot, the magicians of the riffraff of that mixed multitude, the Erevrav, came. Those who went up with them from Egypt, they were magicians, and they made the calf by means of magic. Some say that Micha was there, Micah, for he had come out of the foundations of a building into which he had been crushed in Egypt. He had in his hand an amulet and a plate unto which Moses had written, "Rise up, ox, rise up," with which to bring up Joseph's coffin, his bier from the Nile River. And he, Micha, threw into the melting pot that little amulet, and out came the calf. So we need to discuss this. It's kind of interesting stuff. So what happened? Aaron takes the gold and he throws it into a pot. Did you ever wonder, where did they get the idea of a golden calf? What about a golden Moses? Wouldn't that be a little bit more sensible? It always bothered me, right? Well, why a calf? How did this happen? Aha. I'm glad you asked. Now you're going to know the answer. So while they're in Egypt, we're going way back now, couple months. Pharaoh knew that before Joseph, the Joseph, prince of Egypt, had died, he made his brothers and his children swear that when they would be brought out of Egypt, part of the Exodus, his body, his remains, would have to go with them. And they swore, yes, we'll promise. And then Pharaoh's an ingenious guy. He took Joseph's coffin, and he went to a little river called the Nile River, which is 4,000 plus miles long. And he took the lead-based coffin and he tucked it somewhere in the Nile River, unbeknownst to any of the Jews. Because he figured, look, you know, I like these Jews. Because at that time, it was a friendly pharaoh. I don't really want them to leave ever. And if they swore this solemn oath to Joseph to take his body on, if they can't find the body, then they can't leave. So the night of Passover, We're having our first Seder, we're eating the matzah, looking for the Afikoman, got the blood of the Paschal Lamb on the doorpost, and God is busy not doing such nice things to the Egyptian firstborn. Okay, that was the night. And the Jewish people are busy borrowing, quote unquote, the goodies of their fellow Egyptians. They say, well, do you want to lend us some stuff? But Moses wasn't involved. You know what Moses was doing? He was busy looking, fruitlessly, I might add, for the coffin of Joseph. Now, it's a 4,000 plus mile river. The Nile runs from Egypt, and it really goes down into the depths of deep and darkest Africa. So what is Moses supposed to do? So he's desperate. It's nighttime, and he's looking for Joseph's coffin. So Moses is Moses. Nice little trick. So he takes the amulet, and he writes on the amulet, Allah Shor, Allah Shor, rise, mighty ox, rise, mighty ox. The ox is the symbol of Joseph's tribe, the great bull. So he writes on this little amulet. He blesses the amulet with the name of God, one of the actual, what we call Shem HaMeforash, the actual ineffable name of God, which has like a little bit of a magical property. He takes the amulet and he tosses it into the water of the Nile. Guess what happens as a result? The coffin superinflates with air, and the coffin rises up from the depths, and then there it is. And he and Moses goes and takes the coffin, and they leave Egypt with Joseph. It's not the end of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. Because that amulet wound up, unfortunately, in the hands of a young bad guy, Micha. Now, who is Micha? This is such a great story. Micha died in Egypt. He was a baby, crushed into the walls of one of the pyramids or one of the buildings there. And when Moses asks God, how come you're not acting? How come the babies are being crushed? I know you're going to take us out, but come on, let's get a move on. Why are the babies being killed? And God says, you know, Moses, don't ask me these questions. You can't understand. But know that whoever died would not have a happy ending had they grown up. Okay, but you want proof? Pick someone. So Moses goes, and he finds baby Micah, who had been crushed to death and was buried by the Egyptians as cement in the walls of a building. He takes the little baby, I mean, it's heartbreaking, and he's brought back to life. Only problem is he grows up to become this wicked kid, Micah, who unfortunately creates an image, an idolatrous image, that everybody worships in Egypt. And then everybody worships it across the sea. And then they keep this whatever it's called, a Pesel Micha, this idolatrous object, and there's thousands of people for generations serving this idol. So he's not a good guy. He's there at the fire. So Aaron takes the gold, throws it in, and it's liquefied now. You have molten gold. But it doesn't have any direction or any substance. So what does he take? He takes the amulet that he stole from Moses. What did it say on the amulet? Rise, mighty bull, rise, mighty ox, rise. And it was blessed with the name of God. Takes the amulet, he throws it into the fire. Rise, mighty ox. What is a baby ox? A calf. So there you have the golden calf. So that's how you manufacture a golden calf. Because, see, in other words, using Joseph's tribal name and an amulet that was intended for good, this Micah corrupts and perverts it, and it becomes the golden calf. Now, it's interesting. The word for calf, egel, is also a Hebrew word. Agalah. Ayin, gimel, lamed. Anyone here who has ever said, for example, a Kaddish, the mourner's prayer for the dead, we know that in the Kaddish we say, ba'agalah, Uvizman Karif. The word agala means hurry. Hurried. Move it. And that's exactly what they wanted. Moses delayed. They wanted instant gratification. They wanted their gold. They wanted their calf. They wanted their God. And they wanted it in a hurry. So that's the word. Egel agala means to do it in a hurry. Anything that is rushed without thought process, not a good thing. So what happens? Number 8. Then they shout out, these are your gods. Wait a minute. It does not say, these are our gods. So it should say, these are our gods, Israel, right? No. From this we derive, as Bruce said, that the mixed multitudes that came up from Egypt were the ones that gathered against Aaron. They were the ones that made the calf and afterwards misled the Israelites to follow it. They were the ones who murdered Hur. It was the mixed multitudes. Okay. And then, number nine, Aaron says tomorrow will be a festival for God. He hopes that his procrastination will work. We don't need to go into number nine in detail. And now let's get to number 10 and the end of the source material. So we asked a question at the beginning. How come when Moses hears about the report of the golden calf theoretically up on Sinai, even from God, he kind of like is, all right, why are you getting so hot under the collar, God? But when he himself witnesses it, he gets hot under the collar and crushes the tablets and destroys the people who made the calf. How come this paradigm shift in Moses himself? Because there was something different. Go back, please, to source number 3. And I'll read it much more carefully this time. It happened as Moses drew near the camp and saw the calf of the dances that Moses' anger flared up. He threw down the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. There's one word that was added here that was not in God's report in number 2, and I won't ask you to compare and contrast. Anyone know what the word was? Dances. Dances. He saw the dances. Now, the word for a dance in Hebrew is micholot. It says, Vayar et ha'egel. He saw the calf. Well, that's not new. Ooh, micholot. The dances around the calf. So what were they doing? Anyone been to a Jewish wedding, you know, and you do the, everyone dances around the, you know, everyone sits, sometimes you have the chatan and kala, the bridegroom and the groom, they, you know, they sit in it and they, everyone dances there around in a circle. Well, that's what they were doing. They were all dancing around. They had the calf, the golden calf, set up in the middle, and they were pointing at the calf saying, Eila Elohecha Yisrael, this is your God, Israel, that brought you out from Egypt. This is Moses. Now, Moses only knew up on Sinai because God, that's all God told him. What did he tell him? He told him about the calf, but he didn't tell him about the dancing. Okay, great, wonderful. So why is the dancing such a critical thing? Let me explain. What is idolatry? Idolatry at its source is human projection of a reality. We as humans project and give substance and credibility to something that is inanimate, not part of God. In other words, it's not derived from God. It is derived from humans. So what Moses knew up on Sinai was that they had created a golden calf. So his reaction was, okay, who gave them the gold? You did, Hashem. You're surprised maybe that they built an idol when they are just a few days removed from Egypt? It's not a surprise. So he wasn't worried about that. But when he comes down Sinai, and it's not just that he witnesses the calf, but he witnesses the people parading around the calf in a big tchotchke line, and they're all pointing at the calf saying, this is God. That's what elicited Moses' anger and wrath. And that's why he had no choice but to crush the tablets over their heads, essentially, in a metaphor. Why? Think about it for a moment. It's one thing to project yourself and say, this is reality. Here it is. But then to dance around the reality like it really is real, and to point to it like it's real, you're essentially dancing around your own mind. Because if it's the human mind that created this idol, it's bad enough to believe that that's real. But then to run around it in a circle and say, this is real, let's worship. You're essentially, who are you worshiping? You're not worshiping God, you're worshiping yourself. So at that point, Moses thought, oh my gosh, how do I get out of this? How do you take people away from a golden calf that they've invented, projected, and now give credibility to the point where they're essentially dancing around their own minds? I didn't know about this. And that is the response. Shatter the tablets. Shatter their illusion. Now, how does this relate to then and now? Because I believe that this is a recurring plague in our world. Think about it for a moment. If we invest human sensibility on anything and create from our own mind a reality. But what if that reality is not ordained by God? What if just humans get together and they say, well, this is my reality, and they invent whatever the religion or idol or whatever the paradigm is that we have to believe in, and they pour all their heart and soul into that. But as long as they understand that it's stupid and foolish, it's not really a problem. But when they start killing people over it, when they start worshiping it and saying this is the reality, and it's not from God, it's from the human mind, how do you go back from that? It becomes very difficult. So I believe it plagues our world today. So that's why we call this the golden calf then and now. How do I explain? So let's just take it on an individual level. If you have a person, for example, that is selected and you invest everything you have into that person, at some point that person becomes the golden calf, to the point where even if that golden calf is like the emperor without clothes, you can't cease and desist because you've invested yourself, your mind, your body into a reality. Even when it's clear that the reality doesn't exist, it's very hard to divest yourself and step back from this. And that's unfortunately reality, because we're all guilty of it. And hopefully what we create is just an innocent, innocuous thing. But when it becomes the project, and that the project becomes bigger than human life, oh my gosh. When you start throwing people under buildings and under trains, when it's an ism that you create that's artificial. Now, we all know, looking back at all the isms of history, they're usually like people scratch their head. Like, I guarantee you, a generation from now, people are going to look back who did not live through the 20th century. They're going to say, fascism? Socialism? Communism? Whatever isms you want to throw out there, they're going to say, and for that, 300 million people gave up their lives? Really? And they're going to scratch their heads because they're not going to understand what it meant to invest in such a thing. But that's the problem, is that every time we project that this is the reality, this is our golden calf, over and over again, and we're willing to kill for that, that then it crosses a line and becomes a real problem. So I would suggest to you that, unfortunately, the golden calf may have been shattered on that day. It was destroyed, it was melted down, and was thrown away. But the metaphor for what the golden calf stands for is with us today. So we have to be very, very careful that when we project our human sensibilities on anything, we always have to keep in mind it's human. It's not God. And it's not worth dying for. And it's a very, very scary thing when people believe so much in a philosophy or a religion that they're literally willing to throw their children under the bus, under a fire. It's not a new thing. But unfortunately, we see today, you witness the Middle East, you have this movement called ISIL or ISIS, where they're literally willing to kill everybody in the world. And we look at it and say, well, wait a minute, this is insanity. What they believe in doesn't really exist. What God would offer rape and pillage and slavery on the innocent men, women, and children? Well, who are they praying to, right? But that's the point. That when it's invented by humans, it's like that double-edged sword. All the intentions, the good intentions might be good at the beginning, but then it starts to get off track. And when, so that's why I say, and Judaism has an ISM at the end too. We have to be really, really careful that we have to emulate our founding father and mother, Abraham and Sarah. Do you know that Abraham and Sarah never did anything unless God ordained that they should do it? If God didn't say this is a good idea, Abraham didn't on his own say, gee, I'm going to make it up. Because as soon as Abraham or Sarah makes up something, and even if it sounds sensible and logical, the danger is it can become a golden calf if taken to the extreme by extremists. And what do people do? They start off very innocuously, innocently, with a culture, with a theology, with a philosophy, and then eventually it starts to morph. And even the people who founded the religion will look back and say, oh my gosh, how did I go from this point to the point where you're killing people, you're taking people to gas chambers in my name? What? Are you insane? And yet, it's happened time and time and time again. And if you go back, really, in a way, the original golden calf would have been the Tower of Babylon, because they were willing to literally kill people as long as the project carried on. Famously, when a brick fell off that tower, the people went crazy and they mourned. A brick! It's going to put us back! 2 weeks! It's going to take 2 weeks to get another brick up to the summit of that tower. But when a human being fell off that tower, they're like, oh, okay, no big deal. Human being, just a replaceable unit. Next! Gee, what does that sound like? It sounds like, unfortunately, the 20th century and the view of a Joseph Stalin, yimach shemo, or a Mao Zedong, yimach shemo, or a Hitler, yimach shemo, these horrible people that we had in the 20th century, these nightmarish people who were all into the isms, if you notice, and threw their own people under the bus and killed, I didn't want to guess, 100 million people died? Whatever that figure is, between, they don't even know how many Mao Zedong killed, correct? It's a guesstimate, as they say. But Stalin, we say 25 or 35 million people, and Hitler, yimach shemo, pick your number. It's a big number, cumulatively. And where does that come from? Right here. We have the capability of invention, of projection, and that golden calf might start off as a reasonable idea, and then it becomes something in and of itself. Now the question is, how do I know that I'm worshiping the golden calf? It's a question outside of the parameters of today's class. But I can tell you one thing. We referred to at the outset that little internal voice. If your internal voice is speaking to you loudly, please listen to the voice. And when we invest in things, if it's not written in scripture, if it's just something that someone invented and thinks it's a good idea and then carries on, be very, very careful. Abraham and Sarah, and let's just finish with that. Abraham and Sarah were never into projection. If God didn't tell Abraham and Sarah, do this, then what right, Abraham and Sarah said, do I have to think it's a good idea? In other words, I can anthropomorphize. Well, if I was God, this would be great. Well, guess what? You're not God. And therefore, dare not go where God himself has not gone. Thank you, everyone.